This is Food for Thought. Call Carol at 866-823-1077. And now, it's Food for Thought.
It's 106 on the Pulse, Food for Thought. My name is Mike Moore, and Carol Lawrence is away today. Carrie Lehman is filling in, and if you don't know the name, you certainly know Tidewater Catering Group. That's hers, as is Waterworks Cafe on the Wambeck Mill downtown in the Mill Yard, and newest, Bayona Cafe in the Jefferson Mill Building, kind of at the other end of Commercial Street. And then coming soon to a Sundial Avenue near you will be the Unity Cafe, which is right near River's Edge, the Elliott Complex, and Velcro is there. And that opens when, Carrie? You told me
September.
Yeah, September
should
be
right? It's a great space that where Hester College used to have their cafeteria. So it's right. a great design to start with. And so we're just adding a little love to it.
Well, that sounds great. And I love the description you used about the building, because I've heard architects and builders use the term great bones.
Yeah.
And I've heard that.
It does
TV.
Have great bones. And a lot of it really has to do with being able to put a kitchen in without spending so much money that it becomes.
So you can retrofit it without.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a great design to begin with. So whoever had designed it for Hester way back when did a wonderful job. It just needs a little love and an updating, but and some colors. It'll be great.
Well, maybe I should have introduced you to our next guest a little bit sooner, because much of his world is involved with designing kitchens, although I think more in a residential versus industrial application, although I could be wrong. Stephen Freeman, although I met him under the basis of the Manchester Food Co-op board member a year ago, and we sat down and talked about the Manchester Food Co-op, but he is also a gentleman who works in designing kitchens. Just looking at some plans right there a minute ago for some work he has later on today. Site development and store design guy, Steve Freeman, when's this place opening? I'm just going to start out with the number one question.
Jump right in there.
Yeah, because it's been on the drawing board, I know, for years.
Yeah, right now our timeline is about a 24-month window to close in and open the doors, but it's all subject to several approvals happening through the co-op development world, which has been moving at a nice steady pace we're very proud of. And it's always the question, when are you opening? Where are you going to be? And I always revert back to, how are you helping your store get open? Because this store belongs to the people. It doesn't belong to the board members. It doesn't belong to the city, the government. Mm-hmm. It belongs to the community who has bought in for $100. And it's $100 per purchase. You own a stock share of the business. And most co-ops actually take about 7 to 10 years in the United States to open. This is classified as a consumer co-op, so we're selling directly to consumers, member owners, et cetera. We're in year 5, and we're at the tail end of year 7 before we open our doors on current projections.
7 to 10 years.
Yes. Even if you wanted to open your purse and give us $10 million, which is more than enough to open.
She got her checkbook out.
Yeah,
We'll take it as a donation, but a co-op can't open that way. It has to be born within the community. The community has to buy into it. The community has to show its support.
Really?
That's how it
works. Now, do you have to go to the, like, aldermanic meetings for all these things? Is this part of your process to get the City of Manchester aboard?
We have some, the mayor's a member owner, several department heads and employees of the City of Manchester are member owners. We don't have to go to them just yet. It's not a governmental process,
I see. We will
go to them for a planning board, site plan approval, and building permit when we get closer.
As you would with any
fit-up. As you are for your kitchen.
Correct, right, okay.
Same sort of process when we get to there. We are talking to the economic development about financial opportunities and business partnerships, and we're talking to every avenue we can, because the more players involved, the stronger the success story will be when we open.
All right, so we know that for $100 you can get in and be a co-op part owner. You get an equal share with everybody else. You're at, what, about 1,035 or somewhere in there?
1,043, I think, as of this morning, yes.
Which is terrific. So, but I know that you do have to go for other sources. I don't know if these are angel investors or what other kinds of people, because $100 a time, a person, you really can't build a building in today's world with that and get it started.
Correct. We just did a presentation Saturday. There's like 9 sources for funding that we've currently earmarked. The biggest and most important is what we're going to be releasing after we sign a lease, is our member loan campaign, capital campaign. There's 2 sources we're looking to from our member owners and the public at large. And that's where you, a member owner, provide a loan or preferred shares to the co-op in whatever sum we agree to is the variables, if you will, the range of contribution. And we're projecting, I think, around $5,000 to $7,000 would be the average loan. So that's the first step. Depending on how successful we are there, that takes us to the next step, which is a commercial lending institution. And then there's co-op development funds. There's we've already been guaranteed about $1.5 million in alternative loans from co-op development funding institutions. But the most important thing is we're going to be unveiling next. We're working on the legal language now, is the member loan campaign. In quick numbers, 1,000 members. If everyone could give $5,000, we just raise $5 million. Just like that. It doesn't happen, but we keep
talking. Don't look at me like that.
We keep talking it so that people understand, because a co-op is really a new concept. It's not a new concept, but it's not on the news. It's not a
Tell us, because not everybody will know. That's a very good point, and I should have started out by saying, what exactly is a food co-op, and why should I be a member?
Well, if you like Birkenstocks and granola, then the co-op's for you. Just kidding. That's what I thought it was.
That is a great byline.
I do wear Birkenstocks. A co-op is a business model that is owned by the people whose life it benefits directly. That's what it is. There's not a board of directors and a profit machine. You know, I'll use a big organization out of Arkansas. All the money that you support at their department stores, like 85% of it, is pulled out of our community and brought to the board of directors and the profit shareholders of that organization. A co-op, 67, I think the number is somewhere around there, 67% of the dollars are redistributed into the local economy. So it's really what I've come to learn about a co-op is this is a great way to make the community that I love, that I live in, work in, play in, we raise our kids, we go to school, we eat dinner at restaurants together. This is where I want the best economy in my life, is right here, right now, where I live. And a co-op is a vehicle for redistributing the wealth. I shouldn't say redistributing, but putting money back into the community so we keep jobs very local in our zip code. We keep the farmers of New Hampshire farming to provide to our store.
You're reinvesting.
Reinvesting in your community. And just by us supplying all local suppliers, the money is staying in our community, keeping jobs in our community.
Now, you say our community. Is this Greater Manchester only, or are you supporting, as in some ways, you know, the Hooks at Bedford? How does that work? Because I know there's other co-ops in the state.
Correct. The closest one is Concord, 22 miles north or so.
And they have a store.
The definition of local is defined differently depending on federal government, local government, municipal government. The state of New Hampshire, I believe, calls, in order for you to label it local, it's a 100-mile radius from point of origin. I've sort of defined local for our co-op is if you can pick it from the field or produce it in your kitchen, get in your delivery truck, get it to our store, and get home by sunset. That's local.
Wow.
And truly, when most organic produce, which is a huge market share now, is shipped 3,000 miles away, and it's 10 days old when it hits the grocery store.
How long has the Manchester Co-op been organized?
We're in our fifth year now.
Fifth year. Okay. So now compare that to Concord's.
I don't have their exact history on how long it took them to develop. I know they started as a buying club. So it was a bunch of folks got together in the late 60s, I think, because they're in like their 32nd year. So I'm sorry, 70s.
Wow.
I think Concord's 31, 32, 33 years old.
Oh, so that's considerably older.
So what I say is, so let's say they're 31 years old. 33 years ago, this is what the Concord Co-op was doing.
I think that's an important perspective for those people comparing, as I might, Manchester to Concord. Because as I just said, Concord has a store. It's a big store. It's a new store right on Main Street. And I think that's an important perspective so people don't think, you know, us in Manchester are, you know, going to the beach every day and not working on this.
Right. No, and Concord has grown and expanded and relocated since their original location.
Yes, that's correct. A
couple years ago they did a major renovation.
A major rehaul.
And that actually, their renovation, one of my contractors said, Steve, I think you should go after this job. They need a designer and a contractor. I reached out and then something caught wind of the Manchester Co-op. I said, well, that's closer to home.
Nice.
So I reached out to the Manchester Co-op. Yeah, can I design and build your store? Oh, sure. Come and talk to us.
Nice.
Oh, it's not next month. So then I got roped in as a board member, and I said, you know, it's just one contract. I want to see this store get open. That's what I really want at the end of the day, is I just want to be able to shop here.
Well, somebody did a good job getting you aboard. That's awesome. Yeah,
he is committed, huh?
Absolutely.
Totally committed, because I've learned what the value is to my personal life and, you know, the people I celebrate my life with, my friends and my family. I've always cooked real food, healthy food.
Including professionally,
right, in a past life, and some summer catering gigs that I still keep going on. But I've just made a commitment to my health. I'm in the gym 5 days a week now, and we as a country, more than any other country on the planet, have completely lost connection with our food, and we've reconnected with our healthcare providers and our insurance plans because of that lack of connection. And we really aim to reintroduce real food to the community, teach them how to work with it, teach you what all these local farms are producing, and understand that the best health is your preventative medicine.
Stephen, let me ask you, what does the phrase clean food mean to you?
Clean food?
I had a colleague of mine go on a 3-week clean food diet, and I was perplexed, because I thought, well, what does clean food mean? And she described it to me as a little bit of this paleo diet, but mm-hmm. taking out refined sugars, taking right. out the things that we may, you know, eating natural fruit and natural vegetables in their whole state, not peeling certain things where you might think to peel it, but eating a lot of avocados. I mean, am I right that a lot of people are looking at this as trying to jumpstart their health, their weight loss, invigorate sure. their energy?
Sure. A lot of people, I think, at this time in our life are starting to realize, you know, I'm taking care of my mom. It scares me. And when I go shopping with her, I'm like, cancer, diabetes, cancer. This is all where it's coming from, is all this processed food. So clean food to me is from the farm, from the fields or the farms to your plate, not through a machine, not through a processing, not through a bleaching process. And if we as a country really knew, the products are only labeled, even, you know, say raw almonds. I like to share this information. Raw almonds, I always thought, were picked from the tree and put in a bag. Well, they're not. Under federal regulations, they have to go through a bleach cleansing so that mold doesn't grow. And I was like, well, that's not on the ingredients.
You just got my attention, because I eat 2 ounces of raw almonds a day.
Because they're great for you. But if you knew what was really in all the
your
other
teeth
food,
are really white, by the way. I just want you to know, so the bleach.
Oh, my goodness. How funny. No wonder I smell chlorine.
Yeah.
What is recommended?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know why almonds can't be picked from the tree and put in a bag or a can and sent to us to eat. But our government thought it would be better that they're put through a solution so that mold or bacteria doesn't grow in the bags. But that's just one example I use.
That's a great example.
You know, I was eating some fresh raspberries last night, and they were non-organic, and they were delicious. And I was going to wash them, but I've since learned that it doesn't matter what's on the surface, because it's what's in the soil and the water and the chemicals that were grown with it that are in the raspberries.
Just going to get the sand out. That's about it. If there is any.
Yeah. So it's, or the bugs, or mm-hmm. the dried up leaves. So it says, you know, 100% raspberries made in U.S. or from USA farms. But what they don't tell you is the 55 chemicals that they use on the raspberry fields
on the bushes to grow them.
Because if they did, none of us would be buying food. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, you know, I'm not here to knock the industry. I'm just here to show you a better
way. It's awareness.
And I
think anything that we can, what we just said to Amy earlier, awareness and learning things outside our comfort zone is important.
But we live in such a world of convenience, and it all began really back in the 50s, that we've just become, adjusted to getting things quickly, refined. And now, for some people, there's no going back. Unless you open your mind to what Stephen's talking about.
I commented to someone the other day that I love hummus. Hummus and all those Mediterranean things I love. And I could eat a tub of hummus a week. And
a day?
Oh, my goodness, personally. I love it. I wish I had enough time to eat it for a day.
Do you know what they put in garbanzo beans?
No, tell us.
No, Mike, this is absolutely true, because I took it upon myself to say, you know what, I'm going to make hummus at home. And I thought to myself, this is absurd. It's the same ingredients. So I thought. So I'm putting the natural this, natural that. All of a sudden, I look at the container, and there's 5 ingredients on the container that I don't even think I could pronounce.
Right.
And it's all potassium sorbate and things to make it shelf stable.
Yeah.
And not that they're necessarily, you know, either addictive or disease driven, but they're not natural. So, you know, here I am saying, you know, crying and whining that I actually have to make my own hummus. but it's really, you go back to the convenience. Do I have time to make my own hummus at this point in my life? No. So I have to eat the potassium sorbate.
Oh, okay. Well, but your teeth are still white.
Well,
so.
Well, thank you.
See, but I deviate from that. We're all busy, and that's part of our problem in this country in particular. I make time to take care of my health now. I can do a million things at night. I could certainly – I'm not going to go to my grave and say, I really wish I spent weekends at my job because I really could have done more in that respect. I really want to enjoy my life and my health, and I'm really thinking about my elder years, the golden years, as they call them. I look at the golden years for most people of my mom's generation. They're not so shiny and gold at all.
No. And we're living longer.
We are living longer with more ailments. So I make the time to take care of my diet. And I go out of my way, and it's not really convenient currently in the city of Manchester to find real great food because there's not a co-op in town. And when the co-op opens, you know, I'm the type of guy, I'll shop there 5-7 times a week because I want fresh, real food all the time. And to make fresh hummus, you know, it takes 15 minutes for me to make it at home.
I have to teach my boyfriend to do it. That's the answer to this question.
And it's, you know, I have a week's worth of hummus.
If he's listening right now, he's probably cringing. Yeah.
But to go back to your clean eating question, about 3 years ago, I said, all right, I'll try this cleanse. I did this 30-day cleanse, and it was nothing but organic, clean food, protein shakes, unlimited vegetables. I think broccoli grew out of my ears. And what that did for me was amazing. Yeah, I lost 10 pounds, but it found its way back because I didn't eat that way consistently. But what it did for me is it recalibrated my palate to what real food tastes like. And that's one of the biggest things. Yeah, again, no offense to the brands, but Diet Coke and Doritos taste delicious if they're a big part of your diet. No doubt about it. You go a month of eating nothing but real, raw, unprocessed food. And I was working late at night doing a kitchen installation, and there was an office, and all that they had was salt and vinegar chips, which I used to love.
Yum.
I took one bite. I thought I was sprayed with muriatic acid in my mouth. I was like, wow, this is all what chemicals are. Mm-hmm. But if I was eating salt and vinegar chips every day, they'd be great, and kale would taste like, you know, cardboard door frames. So that's a really important point I want to share is that, yes, real food doesn't taste as glorious as sugar-coated processed foods. But if you start eating a healthier diet, your body, not me, not what anybody tells you, your body will start to wake up and say, boy, that tastes like chemical.
And I feel better for it.
Yeah, and you definitely feel better for it.
I can give you a good example. We just talked about that yesterday. Carol, who is my normal co-host, for about 14 or 15 weeks has been on a real life-altering diet, exercise, make myself healthier routine. And over the weekend, she cheated a little bit. She went on a little trip to Ogunquit, Maine, and she stopped at a place that has her favorite donuts. And after about two bites, she said, this doesn't taste good. Exactly what you're saying. And then she had lobster Benedict, which was one of her favorite dishes. And after a couple bites of that, it didn't do it for her. So her palate has completely done a 180, and you feel like you're cheating, but you know what? You're only cheating yourself if you keep eating that stuff.
Correct.
I mean, I'm guilty, so I eat a lot of that bad stuff, and I eat a lot of good stuff, too, so the bad stuff still tastes good to me.
Mm-hmm.
So
it can be rewarding. I mean, I broke down and bought some M&Ms a few weeks ago, and I could eat 5 pounds at a sitting, no problem. And I had a handful, and I couldn't finish the handful. I was like, I can't believe I had a love affair with these things for 35 years of my life. And now I'm just like, they taste like that, and like all those other things that come in a bag. And the food industry is one of the most profitable, lucrative, smartest businesses in the world. They know how to keep us buying their products. And it's with those certain flavors that, you know, so an M&M's kind of tastes like a Snickers, kind of tastes like a, you know, a factory ice cream sandwich bar. And they all have that similar, I don't know what it is because they don't share it, but there's a common thread that it has an addictive quality.
So when the Manchester Food Co-op opens and the retail space is there, as a member of it, which I am and a lot of other people are at this point, do I have a hand in saying I want Doritos or I don't want Doritos? Or how is the food stock managed on kind of a group basis, or is it?
You do have a say as a member owner, and also, to be quite honest, as a co-op, we're going to respond to what the community asks for, and we've had this conversation as a board of directors often. If we need to sell Doritos and Rice Krispies to stay in business, we're going to. If that's what our community is demanding, we're going to sell it to stay in business, but we hope to sell a lot more natural local products, and you do have a say and we want to keep the store open and profitable. So the bottom line is staying profitable and keeping the doors open.
Well, you have to pay the staff to be there and clean it and maintain it. So
all
and,
those things.
And run a business.
And to that point, Carrie, I saw some stats where, at least nationally, the figures are that people, you know, people that stock shelves or, you know, are clerks at the register actually make more than the average grocery chains pay their people.
Absolutely true.
And that's worth mentioning when we talk about bringing the money and keeping it here.
Correct. Co-op employees at our grocery stores are paid more than the national averages or local averages for the similar position at a competitor's store. We have a much lower carbon footprint than any other type of grocery store, a much higher interest in not just interest, but shelf space dedicated to local consumers. I mean, local providers, which is anybody who grows, manufactures, or produces something locally that has a local ingredient included with it. Our recycling rate typically across the country for co-ops is like 88%, where the national grocery stores is like 27%. So it's all about, you know, the three R's: reducing, reusing, recycling, reincorporating to reduce our costs, reduce our footprint, and really, you know, the scientists are starting to come out with this stuff. This planet isn't ours for the taking. We really got to start taking better care of it. And what we're doing to the soil and the farmland of this country is polluting it with chemicals that this planet can't sustain. So, again, shifting towards a more locally sourced diet. All these small farmers in New Hampshire, they're not part of the big ag system. They want to take care of their land because that provides them their sustenance so they can keep their farmland. So they have no interest, most of them, in going that corporate way. They want to take care of their land because I'll pay you $3 a pound for your tomato if I can sell it to my consumers and they'll eat it like an apple. I'm not going to pay you $1.29 because you grew it in 12 days in this, you know, controlled laboratory.
Yeah, hydroponics.
Hydroponics, right.
Yeah. So they're, you know, reinvesting in the local community is really what this co-op is all about. And, you know, we're going to have classrooms, classroom space dedicated to teaching people how to cook better, how to eat better, how to live better. We're going to partner with health organizations, fitness organizations to make it, you know, a full circle of how to live a healthy life here in the big city of Manchester.
Let's, because our segment's almost done, Stephen. Stephen Freeman from the Manchester Food Co-op, a board member, and as you can hear, very passionate and dedicated to seeing the project through. He is in charge of site development and store designer. That is also his background. All right, so how can people who maybe are not aware of any of this but have somewhat been piqued with what you've told us today, how can they become a part of the food co-op?
You can join online. We have a website at manchesterfood.coop, C-O-O-P. You can click on Join Now. It takes you to our portal, which is our online store. We're running this special right now. We're donated lots of great local products. So if you buy our three bags, which are all handmade by a bunch of wonderful women in Bedford, New Hampshire, 7 minutes away from here, all locally sourced American product materials, recycled commercial window blinds turned into bags. If you buy those three bags right now, they're filled up with food product from a bunch of local producers, which is really an amazing deal. You can find our brochures all over town at different restaurants, different stores. But the website, manchesterfood.coop, is our portal for communication.
Is there a blog or is there information that is continuously updated for people who want to follow this progress?
Facebook?
Facebook.
Okay. I don't know what the #/ thing is, but search for Manchester Food.
I searched it the other day, and it was the first one that popped up. It was really easy, so no sweat.
You'll see, you know, the peepaws. I'm sure my face is littered all over that website or Facebook. And again, it's only $100. It's not a membership per se. You're buying into the business. You're an early founder of the co-op. You're helping us get to our financing. You're helping open the store that we own as a community. And we will continue to always want more membership because it makes for a stronger financial foundation to keep the business afloat.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the bags that are made out of recycled window blinds or, you know, whatever the material is. There's a movement in New York City, I don't know how this is going to work, to try to get all the restaurants to partake in a composting program because of all the food that either gets wasted, gets thrown out, or the raw materials that never make it to the recipe tables.
That would be absolutely life-altering.
Can you imagine, though? Well, they did try it on a very small basis in one borough. And I guess the material got sent to a processing plant, and I want to say Delaware, and it was so overwhelming it closed the place down for 2 days. Oh, they weren't quite ready for it, but on paper it looks like a great idea.
Yep. 30% of the food that we try to produce in this country, including livestock, 30% doesn't even make it off the lot, if you will. So 30% of what is grown or raised
perishes,
spoils, whatever the terms are. That's an amazing billions and billions tons of food that doesn't even get there. And then of the stuff that makes it out of the gate, another 20% is rejected because it's not perfectly beautiful. And there's a movement in Europe for ugly food.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, there's grocery stores that in Europe that are opening up that only sell the odd-looking oranges and apples.
Have you heard about that, Kim?
Yes, I had, actually. They're even trying to figure out a way to ship some of this to third-world countries in a quick way because, you know, countries like Haiti that are one of the poorest countries in the world, they're trying to get them out of poverty through education and nourishment, but some of these children are literally eating one meal a day. Mm-hmm. And you know, how do we help them? And these are the some of the resources when they say, look at the United States that throws out, what was the percentage you used?
30%.
So almost a third of what we're using, we throw away, and there's children.
That's 30% that doesn't make it off the field.
But the three of us here
on average throw out a third of what we buy at the grocery store too.
Yeah, I believe that. Sad, but true.
It's part of because there's so much. I'll take some of that too.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right. Stephen Freeman, again, thank you for joining us. And we'd like to have you back from time to time to keep us updated and get the word out there because it's important information for anybody who truly cares about their health and food. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
My co-host today is Carrie Lehman, and we'll be back shortly. It's Food for Thought on the Pulse WTPL. Heading back shortly.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
136 on the Pulse, WTPL. This is Food for Thought. I'm Mike Moore, and Carrie Lehman is filling in for Carol Lawrence, who will return tomorrow. Our show is brought to you by Puerto Vallarta Mexican Grill on 2nd Street in Manchester and Integrity Health Coaching Solutions, Bedford and Londonderry. And in the not-too-distant future, later this year, in fact, about the time that Unity will be opening, a brand-new location in North Conway for folks to take their vacations or live up there so they can stay in shape and stick with their plan that that Carol is handling so successfully. Want to let you know who's joining us tomorrow, which is Wednesday from the local in Warner. A gentleman by the name of Bill Meadows. Also, Donna's Delight, our funny friend from Delaware, will be phoning in. And she always has some great stories from her deep southern roots, and she'll be sharing a recipe there. Also, George Lawrence, Carol's dad. He is the master of the prime rib cooking and other extravaganzas. He'll be joining us. On Thursday, Michael Hopley Pierce, he hosts a beer podcast called The Tap Handle. I don't know if you've heard that, Carrie, but Stephen is shaking his head. He's heard it. It's really the guy really knows his stuff, does he not? Who else do we have? Oh, Benjamin Goldman from a restaurant that I ate at over the weekend in Cape Neddick, Maine, the Velveteen Habit. Isn't that an interesting name?
I love Cape Neddick.
Yes. And so this restaurant is just it's so very different, and it's just great.
Oh, I'm excited.
So he'll be joining us on Thursday. Chef Patrick, who you met, will be here on Thursday as well. Friday, it's Comedy Cold Cuts, and Chef Nicole from Great New Hampshire Restaurants will be joining us as well on Friday. We're going to take another quick break. Julie Barron from Make-A-Wish New Hampshire will join us, and she always has interesting things to bring to the table as far as some of the wishes being granted and some of the stories that are always worth listening to. So Julie is up next on Food for Thought. It is 1:39. Co-hosting today is Carrie Lehman. It's WTPL The Pulse. Be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
I just feel like listening to Ticket to Ride here, the instrumental version. But I won't. Time is a-wasting. We have important people to talk to, as we do every day on Food for Thought, a program that is brought to you in part by Integrity Health Coaching Solutions, Fallon's Furniture, and Red Arrow Diners of Manchester, Milford, and now, with the brand-new drive-thru opening in Londonderry, it's the Red Arrow Diner. .com. Of course, our usual host is Carol Lawrence, your co-host, my partner. She is away today. Carrie Lehman is here. She of Tidewater Catering and some really terrific restaurants in the Mill Yard, and a brand new one called Unity showing up sometime this fall or late summer, I guess. over on Sundial Ave where Hesser College used to be and where Velcro is. That's a terrific campus to be serving. And I'm sure they'll be much appreciative if any of them have eaten at Cafe Bayona or Waterworks.
Well, thank you. And I wanted to give a shout-out because this weekend I had the opportunity to try one of Carol's spots in Milford, Jay's Tavern. Mm-hmm. And I had never been and went there and absolutely loved the atmosphere. It was very community-driven. They have a little patio out there. They were doing a really, really nice thing for a local family struggling to pay bills for someone with a fatal illness. And so every certain drink or food item you got, $1 of the proceeds went back to the family. So I thought that that was a wonderful thing to tie into, you know, everyone's discussion here today, Stephen and Amy's discussion about giving back to community. So a shout out to Carol's team there for doing that for a local family in Bedford.
Yeah, you don't
Milford, excuse me.
You don't have to look really far to find people that need help in today's world. In this most affluent nation on the planet, there are still those that fall upon hard times. And I guess that's a good transition into speaking with Julie Barron of Make-A-Wish. She's the president and CEO and brings such good news every week from something that, you know, is not always filled with good news and some sadness. But you find a way to put a lot of smiles on people's faces. And at the end of the day, that must be where you draw most of your satisfaction as the person who is the boss upstairs.
It's true. And hello, everyone. And, you know, a shout out to Carol for that, too, because, you know, what's amazing to me is we do see so many children in what I do who, you know, who are going through so much. But it's amazing the people that come out of the woodwork to help them and to support them and to share their strength with them. So it's absolutely amazing. But
yeah, the Make-A-Wish Foundation on a national level is how old, the organization?
We actually turned 35 this year.
Wow.
So 35 years ago, you know, that very, very first little boy, Chris Gracious, he wanted to be a police officer. And yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And so his mom, knowing that he wanted to be a police officer, got together with a couple of community members. They created this experience for him. You know, they had a whole outfit made for him. And, you know, he had rides in helicopters. And my favorite story about Chris Gracious is that they gave him a little tablet to write tickets. And he walked around his neighborhood and he gave everybody a ticket.
That's great.
I thought that was the best.
Showing gratitude, isn't
yeah.
it?
And this was where did this all start?
It was in Phoenix, Arizona.
Phoenix. Okay.
So what happened was after Chris passed away, you know, a couple of these police officers and Chris's mom sitting around the kitchen table one morning thought, well, wasn't this an amazing thing that we did for Chris? And wouldn't it be really, really cool if we could do this for more children? And that's how Make-A-Wish was born.
When did New Hampshire become a part of the organization?
We were incorporated in December of 1986, and we actually granted our first wish in 1987. So we are 28, 20, 29 years old now. So what happened was they started granting these wishes in Phoenix, and the publicity started to kind of really get out there that this was happening. And so people were wanting to start their own chapters locally. And so chapters were started all over the all over the country, and actually pretty much all over the world, except for a couple third world countries, there's a Make-A-Wish. So we're all, it's kind of the best of both worlds because we're all independently incorporated. So we are a 501c3 organization right here in New Hampshire, but yet we're part of a federation. So it's like having, you know, a whole world full of your peers. So that's what's great. And I've talked about it before where, you know, we have a child that wants to be something. And we would call up our counterparts wherever, and they would help us with all the ground stuff. They know where
pull
to stay,
those resources
what to do,
together.
Pull in all the resources.
Beautiful.
And, you know, so we would pay for it, put them on a plane, and their people and their volunteers would be there on the ground to intercept that child and give them this amazing wish experience that they would like. And then they put them back on the plane or wherever and send them back.
Now, your offices are here on Elm Street, are they not?
Yeah, right upstairs.
How
it's
nice.
Amazing.
How
yeah.
nice. And how do you get the funding? How do people reach out and say, this is something I want to be part of, I want to contribute? Maybe I can't, you know, loan out a helicopter, but how do I contribute?
Well, we have amazing clubs, organizations, groups out in the community that raise money for us and donate to Make-A-Wish. And then we have donors that, you know, just donate dollars to us. Amazing in-kind donations. So it really comes through all different directions. Our average wish cost is about $10,000. And so, you know, we have donors that want to sponsor an entire wish. And then we have donors who want to give pieces, and then we'll put that all together and bring that child's wish to life.
Do you do an annual fundraiser? Do you have one of these annual galas that so many of these organizations
have? Yeah, we don't have an annual gala. We have a gala that one of our donors puts on for us that we do each December. We probably have over 300 external events out in the community.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah, which is absolutely amazing. There's something happening all the time, whatever it is. I think we have five or six different golf tournaments. We have a huge rafting event that we do up north that's coming up. We have wish racers that race for us in the Timberman event up north. So, you know, any type of activity you want to be involved in, you know, we have something, and that's really a lot of how our funds are created. That and our big breakfast.
Yes, that was a couple of weeks ago where you did the actual reveal of a wish being granted in front of hundreds of people, and it was just an amazing moment from what I understand.
Yeah, it was so cool. Yeah. And we're having a special get-together with some of our donors coming up next Monday with Matthew, who's back, and he's going to do a little puppet show for them.
Yeah, to explain to Carrie, this little guy wanted to, just fascinated with puppetry, and he was sent to a puppet theater college or something?
Yeah, well, part of his wish, too, was that he just didn't want to be just a puppeteer. He wanted to be a Disney puppeteer. And so we got the Florida Puppet Guild involved, and, of course, Disney involved, and, you know, he had this, you know, whole week experience hanging out with all these puppeteers, doing video puppet shows, making puppets, learning exactly all the positioning to do puppet shows. And, you know, we gave him a whole puppet theater, so he's got all that. So it turned out to be an amazing, really touching experience.
A lot of generous spirit out there.
Yeah, a lot of generous spirit. Yeah, and we brought that fish tank wish to life that I was talking about last Tuesday, Saturday.
Yeah, review that again, because it's a television show, although I don't think they became officially part of it, right?
Well, his wish wasn't to be on the television show, okay. But his wish was that he wanted them to make him a fish tank.
Is this the show Tanked?
This show Tanked, yeah.
Which is
how do you have time to watch that?
It is it's hysterically funny sometimes.
So as kind of an extra thing, though, the guys from Tank Skyped in to his wish on Saturday so they could see the big reveal and see them giving him a tank. But part of it, and what the really cool thing was, is that he drew out, this child had this amazing imagination. He wanted a big pirate ship in his tank. And so they, with all the detail, made him an old pirate ship with the sails coming down. I wish I could show you guys pictures, because it was truly amazing.
Was it guys
to see
from the
it
show
with all the detail?
That did it, or
they made
their
it.
Crew?
No, yeah. They made it. Yeah. Well,
I think they're from Jersey, you know.
I don't know.
I think those guys.
Do we know anybody
else
from Jersey?
That's why I watched the show.
Oh, is that it?
I'm from Jersey. They're from Jersey.
So here's a question. We've talked about all the different types of wishes, but we've never asked, because this is a food show, has any of the wish granting been to somebody who wanted to be a chef or work in a restaurant or anything like that?
We haven't had that yet, but I'm hoping that, you know, participating in the show kind of spurs that on. But we've done special things where, you know, a wish child wants to feel really special as part of their wish. And the Barbie Dreamhouse wish that we talked about a while ago, we added a component of that in because we had talked about it so much here that we got the idea. So, she wanted to feel like she was Barbie, and Barbie had her own chef and special, you know, wine. And
I want my own chef.
Tasting. Yeah, yeah. So as part of her wish, we did that for her.
That's
and she had a whole
awesome.
Special food tasting and, you know, kind of a real special moment. And the chef came out, you know, to every restaurant they went to and spent some time with her and stuff like that. So, you know, that was all from the imagination from just being here. And she loved that part of it.
Oh, good.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, the sky is the limit. And literally, because we've talked about this, Carrie, for the last couple of weeks, there is one wish child who wants to go to the moon, why wouldn't somebody ask for that? And so where do you stand on that? You were gonna
I knew you were gonna ask
that. Well, I know there's possibly some conversation of dealing with Houston or Cape Kennedy or whatever it is.
He has decided that he might want to do something different. So we're just saying, I think he just wanted to see what the reaction was. And so So stay tuned for that. We still don't have any comeback because we posed a bunch of different things to him. And he's like, well, you know, I'm not sure. You know, maybe I'd now like to go to Africa or something. So who knows?
Wow.
The moon.
The moon.
Yeah.
The moon.
I think that was a reaction getter. I think he just wanted to see it. But like I was talking a couple of weeks ago, I was just waiting for that. I mean, because
it had
to come sooner or later. I was like, yeah, we'll work on that. And he goes, oh, no, I really don't want to do that. I just was trying to see if you'd actually say no to something.
Yeah. Oh, that's priceless.
How many Wish kids come into the picture every week? Or is there any way to know what to expect volume-wise?
Right now we're doing a wish about every 4 days.
Wow. So that's what, 90 a year almost, huh?
Yeah. We probably won't get that quite this year, but we'd like to get to a pace where we're doing one every 2.5 days. That would be our goal.
That's a lot of work and a lot of sick children.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish, it's funny because I talk so much about, wanting to grant more and more wishes each year. And, for us, I forget sometimes I have to stop and slow down and explain that. It's not that we are expecting more children to be diagnosed. We just want to make sure that we reach every child in New Hampshire who is facing a life-threatening medical condition. We're not there yet.
How do they reach out to you as we wrap the segment up? Julie, give the contact information.
Sure. They can go right online to nh.wish.org. They can give us a call at our office, which is 623-9474. They can email us at info@nh.wish.org. What are other modes of transit? They can text me. They can come
Google
to us in any
you.
Way
there
they want.
Go.
They can Google us.
We are out of time. Julie Barron, Make-A-Wish. Always good to see you.
It's great to see you.
See you next Tuesday.
Keep up the good work.
Carrie Lehman.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Outstanding job as co-host today.
Thank you.
You will be back.
It is my pleasure.
See you tomorrow.